Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. It once again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse's Stop Child Abuse Now radio show. My name is Charles J. Stecker Jr. I go by Charlie, and tonight I will be hosting along with our co-host Carol out of New Jersey. And before I bring in our guest, let me introduce him. Tonight's special guest is Dr. Robert T. Mueller. He's a professor of psychology at York University in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. He's the author on trauma and mental health, a fellow at the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Disassociation, and founding editor of an online magazine, The Trauma and Mental Health Report, that's now visited by over 100,000 readers a year. His new book, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up, describes how to use attachment and trauma therapy in a psychotherapy relationship to help clients find self-understanding and healing from trauma. Dr. Mueller provides the steps needed to build and maintain a strong therapist-client relationship, one that helps bring recovery and growth. My interest in trauma work stemmed from my past, my family's history. Parents were school-aged children during the Holocaust. Rob says they survived only because of a combination of luck and the goodwill of non-Jewish family members who took great personal risks to help. He explains that the legacy of the Holocaust for him was a loss of childhood. It's hard for me to imagine the terror my parents felt as children, terror so many others felt as well. Dr. Mueller admits that these stories occupy a large space in his mind and have had a large impact on his life. An award-winning author, he's also served as lead investigator on several multi-site programs to treat interpersonal trauma and has lectured internationally. So without further ado, please allow me to introduce Dr. Robert T. Mueller and welcome him to our NASA family. Hello,
Thank
Dr.
You.
Mueller.
Hi,
you're live and on air.
Okay, great. Great. Hi, Charlie. Nice to meet you.
Likewise.
Hello. Yeah.
Hello,
okay,
I'm
good.
Here, Dr. Mueller.
Okay, good. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. I'm gonna bring in our other co-host, Carol, out of New Jersey.
Okay, great.
Get her mic up now.
Yes. Yes, I'm
here. Hey Carol, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm glad to be here. And what a wonderful guest that we have, too, Dr. Mueller. You know, thank you so much for being on our show.
I'm
looking forward to the show.
It's really good. I am, too. I mean, it's really such an important issue, and I feel so passionate and strongly about it. And I think that the more that we can do to disseminate knowledge about the area of trauma and mental health and the consequences of child abuse treatments for survivors of abuse, I think that's just such an important thing that we can do.
No, I couldn't agree more.
I do stand in agreement with what you said, Dr. Mueller, in agreement with Carol. So what an amazing resume in the little bit I was able to introduce you from our introduction. What an amazing resume, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to share with us this evening and gleaning some more knowledge to help both myself and our listeners. Just wherever you want to start, let's go from there, and we'll take it.
Okay, great, yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that a lot of survivors don't realize is that there is actually help available. One of the consequences of psychological trauma, physical, sexual abuse, emotional trauma, one of the consequences is that people so often are left feeling alone in their suffering. And there's a sense that they're the only ones who've gone through this, because very often when you go through abuse, you are told, keep this a secret, keep silent about this. You know, if you say anything, I'm going to deny it, things like that. And so people feel like people hold it inside, and then they really feel alone in the whole thing. And so something like this, a show like this, is so important because it really helps bring out to others just how much they're not the only ones who've gone through this, and that there are others who've gone through very similar experiences.
Yes, yes, absolutely. While I am the host, I'm also all ears because I have just an amazing feeling that by the end of the show, I'm going to be able to have some more in my arsenal, not only for myself and my healing, but those others that I know. We do have an additional panelist in tonight, so let me get him introduced real quick, Dr. Muller, and let's bring in Joe from Iowa.
I'm sorry, what was that?
That's it. Hey, Joe, are you with us here?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that.
Okay, we're just...
No.
Are you
going to
be part of the panel tonight, or you just want to listen in?
I'm just going to listen in, but I just want to thank the doctor for joining us tonight, and I look forward to what he has to say.
Okay.
Good,
well,
thank
Dr.
You.
Muller,
yeah, I'm really glad to hear that. Thank you. That's really nice. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you, too.
And if I can just say one more quick thing. You hit on something before when you said people that have been through some type of abuse, for me it was physical, emotional, you do feel all alone, years removed, and you try to find acceptance in all the wrong places.
Mm-hmm.
That was my case, and there's repercussions for that, because oftentimes, at least for me, I'd get involved with relationships with women or people I thought were my friends, and I thought they were accepting me for me, but just take your kindness for weakness or whatever the case is. And I remember before my mom left my stepdad for the last time, we did go to counseling, family counseling, maybe on a handful of times, but it always ended up the same way, where she would point the finger in the session at me and my sister. Everything was our fault. And go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, no, please, you continue. I want to allow you to finish, and then I want to get Dr. Muller on and bring on his things, but definitely finish off, because it actually sounds like what you're doing, and it's wonderful. And Dr. Muller's new book out, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up, you're opening up, so I do not want to cause you to close up again. So please share the remainder of what you want to.
Okay, so what I was going to say is that the counseling was not effective for us as children. And then years later, I got involved with the 12-step program and became a Christian, and that was for me my healing in a sense. And I wrote a book to try to help people who've been through a similar background to let them know that, at least for me, my story is not unique, but I found a place in my life where I was able to let go of all that unforgiveness, hatred, anger, and resentment. And hatred. And when I was able to do that, it allowed me to be a great dad and break that cycle.
Wow.
There you go.
Yeah, Joe,
there you go,
Joe. There are a couple of important points that I want. Is it okay if I respond to a couple of Joe's points?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, Dr. Morrow.
Yeah.
This is your show.
Yeah. Oh, no problem. Okay, so a couple really, I mean, three things I want to respond to. The first is the issue of people confusing kindness for weakness. That is such a common theme when people have been through trauma, is it's really hard for many people to feel vulnerable. When they show vulnerability, then sometimes, or if they show empathy for others, or if they receive empathy from others, they feel vulnerable and feel, here's the word that I often hear is, I'm being weak. And that's a really important red flag. If you feel that you're being weak just because you're being kind, there may be something a little bit, you know, off there, because you've had to sort of show a tough attitude. And so very often people struggle, but there's real strength in vulnerability, and that's part of the problem. In order to engage in intimacy, in order to have relationships, you have to be able to be a little bit vulnerable. So that's the first point I want to respond to. Second point is the idea of parent denial. That's a very common thing. When kids have been through abuse, it's very common for the parents, actually, if it's parents who are abusive, I mean, it's not always, but if the person who was doing the abuse very often will deny that it happened. And so it's a very frustrating experience confronting the person who was abusive, because more often than not, and sometimes they take responsibility, but very often they don't. So it can be very frustrating. And the third point I want to make is around spirituality. I happen to be Jewish. Joe, obviously you found solace in Christianity, or spirituality is Christian. That's fabulous. I think spirituality can be such an important tool. I don't want to say it as though it's just a tool, but it is often a way that people can feel a connection to others. And so, you know, obviously if someone's not spiritual naturally, then you don't want to force it upon them. But the idea of being able to find a sort of spiritual voice in yourself can be very healing in trauma for many people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those are just some of my thoughts about that.
You said to get close to people, maybe in an intimate context or whatever. For me, for years, trust was a big issue for me.
Mm.
You know, trusting people.
Mm.
Huge,
okay.
Huge. I couldn't trust my mother,
yeah,
my stepfather,
mm-hmm,
my father. How can I trust these people? And, you know, for even until my adulthood, for years, it was a real problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very,
I feel like I've over.
That's a mm-hmm, that's a common thing. Yeah.
It is very common. I'd like to say something here, Charlie. What you're experiencing, what you're going through right now, is what we as survivors go through, okay? And you've come quite a ways along in your healing journey, and you're in touch with all of your feelings. You had an unfortunate past, and we all have had unfortunate pasts. Sometimes we have a guest on who went a different direction, and also, too, this man here, this doctor here, this good man here, there's Holocaust involved in his family. This is his show, so we're going to hear about what he went through, what his family went through, and how he, you know, came to be what he is today.
Okay,
Joe,
yeah,
I want
I'd be
you,
happy to.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And Joe, I want you to call in more often, okay? And if you ever feel like reaching out, we do have a contact list, okay? And that's right on the front page of NASCA. And feel free to call any one of us, you know, if you need to speak to people, because you are never alone. We're here.
Right.
Okay. So this is this doctor's show, and we have to learn about what he does exactly. And I'm thankful that he spoke to you as he did. And this is a good thing. This is a good thing. But do call in, okay? I'd like that. We'd all like that. Okay, doctor, maybe you can go on with exactly what you do in the mental health field. And
sure,
and
sure.
You go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, I just want to make sure I'm remembering correctly. Is your name Carol?
Yes, I'm Carol. Mm-hmm. I'm vice president now.
Okay.
I'm on the board.
Okay, okay. Fantastic. So, yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to respond a little bit to what you asked me about regarding my family. Is it that what you wanted me to, one of the question you wanted me to respond to now?
Well, you can respond to the last thing that you were speaking about, how you interact with your clients, and also to trust issues. You were starting to get involved with you face. Yeah, mm-hmm. Maybe you could do that. And then we'll start asking questions. Go ahead.
Sure, absolutely. So one of the things that is really important in therapy is obviously to build, you know, if you're a therapist working with people and if you're a client receiving therapy, or if you're sort of involved in the field in some sort of way, if it's a 12-step program of some sort, trust is so critical, and being able to gradually form what's called a therapeutic relationship. And the therapeutic relationship ultimately it's a healing relationship. It's an opportunity to be able to interact with someone who has some experience about trauma and who is not going to push you to talk about things too quickly. One of the problems that we sometimes see in the field, especially when, you know, some traumatic event happens, like in Toronto where I'm living and where I'm where I am right now, there was a very recent event. I don't know if you call it event, a tragic event on Yonge Street, one of the largest thoroughfares in the city, where somebody with their van killed, I don't remember, it must have been a half a dozen or a dozen people. I don't remember the exact number. This happened a few months ago. What often happens after something like that, a big traumatic incident like that, is that individuals get called in to do trauma counseling. Now, I've got nothing against that. I think that's fine. What people sometimes imagine is that they're going to sit down with you and you're going to get out all your feelings, just pour them out, and then all of a sudden you're going to be okay after, like, you know, 2 hours of just spilling your guts. And it doesn't work that way in trauma therapy. It just doesn't work that way. I mean, it's okay to sit down with somebody. In fact, it's a good idea to sit down with somebody after a tragic event like that has happened. Sit down with them, say, hey, how you doing? You know, if you feel like talking, I'm here. You know, what's going on for you? Just kind of a generic sitting down and being with the person and checking in with them. That's fine. In fact, that's good so that people don't feel like they're alone. And some people do want to talk. They do. They absolutely have a lot to say. But then there are others who really don't. And so you want to gauge something like that. If you're a therapist or something like that, a first responder to events like that, not to push people to talk before they're ready. It really is a process. And some people really need to feel ready to be able to reach a point where they can open up. And that's a very important part of the process. So that trust building process, for some people, it's fast. Like literally within a couple sessions, they want to open up. They want to talk. They have a lot to say. They've got a story to tell. And that's okay. That's great. I see clients like that sometimes. But sometimes I have to actually slow people down a little bit because I get a little worried. If somebody comes in and they sound almost too eager to talk about a traumatic event, I worry that although they do want to share their story, what might happen is, you know, in the elevator ride down after they meet me or in the bus ride home or whatever, they think to themselves, oh my God, I spilled the beans, and they feel humiliated because it's a very personal thing. So I sometimes have to slowly, gently, in a caring way, put the brakes on and say, okay, you know, this is really important what we're talking about. Is this kind of what we're going to be thinking about together as we work together, without kind of having them go into the gory details, you know, the first 10 minutes that I meet them? So that's an important part of the process, is letting yourself as a therapist or letting yourself as a client, if you're going through therapy, do it gradually, you know, just slowing it down a little bit. We all want to do things quickly, but something like trauma really requires trust. So that's an important. So that point about trust that Joe made is so central.
I agree. Go ahead, Charlie.
So those are some of my thoughts. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm listening. I'm learning. I'm taking notes. I'm interested in the beginning of your story or where things began. I read at the end there how and Carol, my gracious co-host, mentioned about the Holocaust and your family's experience with that. If you don't mind, if you want to share some of that with us and your experience and how that's aided you in what you're doing today.
Yeah, I would. And so one of the things that's so bizarre about trauma is that you keep growing and learning about your own past, even if you're working in the field. And I've been in the field for about 20 years, but it was only about 10 or 15 years ago, maybe more, maybe 30 years, actually, as I think about it. Actually, it's been 30 years since my early 20s, and I'm 54 now. I only realized in my 40s, ultimately, why exactly I made my way into the field. I used to think that it was because, you know, oh, this is a really interesting research area, and a very kind of intellectual answer. But the real truth is that I grew up, and I knew these stories about the Holocaust, of course, growing up, but I didn't put that little piece of information together with that's why I went into really wanting to help people who were traumatized. And my parents, as you mentioned, were school-age children during the Holocaust. So they were kids. My dad was 10. My mom was 7. They lived in Hungary, and Hungary was occupied really only during the last year of the wars when Jews were really killed. Prior to that, they weren't. Poland and in other Eastern Bloc countries, Jews were killed for many more years than in Hungary. But in Hungary, it was really between 1944 and 45 or so that the majority. And so it was a very dangerous time for my parents. They were hidden. They were children, and they were separated. They were put into hiding with families, Christian families, who were these individuals who took these risks. I mean, it's crazy. If they would have been caught, these people, they would have been killed. These people who hid my parents didn't know each other. Obviously, they were little kids, but by chance, their families adopted similar strategies and separated all the children in the family. There were many families that did this, that separated the children, put them into hiding. And so my mom in particular almost didn't see her parents. She was 7 years old, didn't see her parents for 6 months. And several times there were people in the building that she was in who wanted to give her into they were called the Aerocross, the Hungarian Nazi Party. They they wanted to give my mother in. My mother was terrified. I mean, just terrified. So I grew up with these stories about the Holocaust when I was a kid, and really the legacy, as I mentioned in the book, the legacy of the Holocaust was, I feel, the loss of childhood for my parents, because my parents were children during the Holocaust. And I didn't really realize just how much my parents had lost their childhood. I knew, you know, I'd been through therapy even before that, and I knew how much I felt my dad in particular didn't know how to be a father for a kid. I mean, he was a very serious man, very, very serious. And he changed a lot when he became a grandparent. When my father became a grandparent for my kids, he became much more playful, but he just didn't know how to be playful. He, you know, after the Holocaust was over, my father's father was murdered during the Holocaust. My dad obviously knew this. And then after this, my dad went to work. So as an 11-year-old boy, he had to learn a trade. He became an upholsterer. And at age 14, by the time he was 14, he was working and making money and contributing to the family household income, which was basically his mom and my dad's sister. So my dad, as an 11-year-old boy, kind of had to become the man of the house. So really lost his childhood. And I think it's a bizarre kind of trauma to go through. I mean, it's not your typical, you know, I mean, it's different in many ways. But I do think that it really did traumatize my parents, both of them, and I think that that's probably what drew me to the field more than anything.
Mm.
So those are some.
And
that's my general story, background story.
Certainly, and to have to be that close in touch with such a traumatic event in the history of Judaism, and to have that close of a tie to it. What age do you recall actually learning that your parents were survivors of that, if you don't mind sharing that with us?
I don't mind sharing it at all. So I grew up with stories of the Holocaust. So they aren't all, believe it or not, they aren't all horrible stories, because they, at the end of the day, they were kids. And so they would do things like get in trouble in little ways and find ways to be kids, even though it was difficult for them. My mother-in-law tells a story, because she was also actually she was 14 during the Holocaust, and she discovered smoking with her friends when she was hidden, and so she tells that some of the time they actually had a lot of fun, believe it or not, because they kind of a lot of the time didn't know what was even going on or how much danger they actually were. But I grew up with lots of stories of the Holocaust in my family. And so, ever since I was a little kid, I knew about this. And it's interesting, because there are other families, so I talk about this in my book, that there were other families, especially my family in Hungary, who I still keep in touch with, my extended family, who never talked about the Holocaust. So their kids have this, the kids in those families, there's this horrible secret that, oh my gosh, a lot of them don't know that they're Jewish. And when they found out they were Jewish, they would get upset with their parents, hey, why didn't you guys ever tell us this? And the reason they didn't know that they were Jewish was because it was seen as a humiliating thing and a dangerous thing. Even after World War II in Europe, especially in Eastern Bloc countries, there was a lot of anti-Semitism even after World War II. It was a communist bloc. It was dangerous actually to be open about being Jewish. So their families kept their past a secret. So essentially, there was this traumatic event, and when they had kids after the war, they didn't tell them, their family's story. They didn't tell the family's history at all. Again, to try to protect their kids, but, it meant growing up, for some of them, from some of my family in Hungary, it meant kind of growing up in this environment of secrecy, where they didn't know, why is my family like this? How come I don't know anything about my grandparents? How come, what the heck's our story? And they didn't know. So I grew up in a very different kind of situation, where my family did talk about their past. My parents did.
Well, I'm glad they did, and I'm sure that helped you. Carol, wanted to share something about Carol?
Oh, I was just going to share that my husband, who passed away a little over a year ago, was Jewish. He was from Brooklyn. And Levin. You can't get too much more Jewish than that.
No,
you can't. And, I'm a Christian. He was a Jew, so there was always a lot of conversation going back and forth. But, there was a lot of things that happened with the Jewish people. In fact, our founder, Bill Murray, even made a video where he shows children. I've used that video at colleges where I've spoken and so forth, where it shows it as being like the ultimate type of, child abuse, and because it's so awful. So there are a lot of stories, and there's a lot of prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's getting better, though. It is getting better. Go ahead.
I think that's an interesting segue.
Go ahead, Charlie, yeah.
I just want to say, I think that's an interesting segue back in to the title of your book, your new book, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up. What an amazing opportunity you had at such a young age to have transparency brought to you in the opening up of the story from a young age, and how you may be utilizing that and applying that in your skill set now to help others with that. I know we definitely want to talk some about your book this evening as well. excited to hear about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I did learn a lot of stories from my parents, and I agree with you that that's influenced me. One of the things I talk about in my book is the idea of storytelling in families. There's some interesting research that a few developmental psychologists have done a few years back around the idea of family storytelling. And in my my online magazine, the Trauma and Mental Health Report, we've written a few articles about family storytelling and how helpful it is. Like families where they share stories, it's a very healing process. And kids, I find that kids, when they find out from their parents, especially things that their parents maybe aren't so proud of, you know, like things that were, you know, show a certain amount of vulnerability in the parents. When kids hear that, and when parents are honest and say, you know, that was hard for me when such and such happened, or when, you know, I went through this experience. Now, obviously, these are things you want to share at a time that it's developmentally appropriate for the child. Because if you get into, you know, too much upsetting stuff when a child is really, really young, then of course that can be very disturbing to kids. So these things, you know, need to be shared at a kind of a pace that is okay for children. But, you know, I find that even like with families that I work with, you know, where parents, let's say, struggled with substance abuse, you know, with addictions, and they have a child, a teenager, who's 13 years old, and the parents are like, oh, I don't want to tell them that I had a terrible alcohol addiction. And I'm sort of, I say to them, what are you waiting for? Your child's 13. Your 13-year-old child can hear about this, and this is something that you can talk to them about. And when they start sharing, I find that kids, like, there's a sort of empathy often that they have for their parents, and a sense, oh, okay, so my parents also struggled with this or that. And then when the parents share some stories, especially when there's a little bit of vulnerability in the story, when the parents say, you know, this was, you know, when this happened, I was, you know, really scared, or when this happened, I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, when there's vulnerability that the parents share, there's a real point of connection that happens between parents and kids. So I find that those kinds of things are very important. Family storytelling is hugely important. In terms of my book, and in terms of opening up, one of the things that is a critical piece in the book is how important the psychotherapy relationship is. And I talk about this in chapter 8. There are a number of different important pieces in the book, and I can touch on some of them. Another very, very important piece is around pacing and psychotherapy. People who open up, I already mentioned this, too quickly, that can be a bit of a problem. And so it's really important for the therapist to really slow the process down and to do it bit by bit. The basic order of therapy in trauma is to first help people establish some sense of safety. And unless they feel that they can trust their therapist, you know, and that's a gradual process, unless they feel that they can manage their overwhelming feelings a little bit and you know, teaching them some relaxation skills or grounding skills, that's very important. That's the early stage of therapy. That's the first stage. The second stage of therapy is something called remembrance and mourning, but the important piece around there is you start to tell your story. It's starting to talk a little bit about the traumatic event, and there are many different ways to talk about the trauma. One way is to talk about it verbally, but some people aren't big talkers, and I find some people like to write aspects of their story down and actually, you know, and bring it into a session, and then I read it, you know, maybe I read it alone, quietly to myself, and then we talk about it, and they find it much easier. That way it doesn't feel shameful to them to actually say it in words. And then as we talk about it, they do start to talk about it in words. But, you know, it's easier if they can just write down parts of it. And so I use whatever tools. Some people like to draw aspects of their story out. So they, and I say to them, okay, let's start talking a little bit about what happened. And they say, you know what, let me draw a picture. And they draw, this is my anger. And I don't know exactly what the anger means just yet, but it's a segue into, okay, what was it that made you angry? And then we start to kind of open up through that. So they use various, you know, we can use various techniques to start to have them open up. And then the third, the third piece of trauma therapy is something called reconnection, where people start to reconnect to members of their community and to things about themselves from the past. And so in reconnection, very often people have isolated themselves. So I work with them around joining groups. Sometimes it's survivor groups. Sometimes it's yoga groups for trauma. That can be very helpful. Sometimes it's self-defense. Martial arts for people who are trauma survivors can be incredibly helpful. So I help them kind of connect with others who have had similar experiences. That kind of broadly gets the kind of process of therapy.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Muller, if you don't mind, I mean, I would love to find a way to obtain a copy of this book. Is it actually out in print and ready to go yet, or is it coming soon?
It's out. Yeah, no, it is out. It was released in the fall, so just a few months ago. Just go to Amazon.com, honestly, is probably the easiest way. Go to Amazon.com and type my name, Robert T. Muller, M-U-L-L-E-R. You'll see both my books, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up, and my first book, Trauma and the Avoidant Client. So the first book is a little bit more about specifically people who are kind of avoid dealing with their traumatic stories. They and I don't mean avoidance in a kind of a, I'm not critical of them for avoiding. In fact, avoiding is a coping strategy that many people use. So it's not a, you know, a bad thing. It's just kind of where they're at in their healing. Like, you know, it was so difficult that they kind of shut all that stuff out. And in therapy, you know, that's sort of a slow process of, you know, kind of thawing the freeze, so to speak, you know, so, you know, because they start off with many kind of avoidance strategies. Sometimes people use alcohol as a way of avoiding dealing with their pain. Sometimes people use sexual addiction. You know, there are a lot of things people do to cope. And again, I don't mean that in a critical way. It's like, you know, some people, you know, need to do that to survive what they've been through. But anyway, in terms of getting the book, you can get it on Amazon.com. It's probably the easiest way to get it.
Well, I'm looking forward to obtaining a copy, and I make numerous trips up into Toronto each year. And I'm going to make an extra effort to get up there and actually come meet you in person and have you autograph my book.
Oh, I love that. That's so cool. That's fantastic. You make it to Toronto. That's nice to,
yes,
nice
I
to
actually,
hear.
This is your show. Are you familiar with a Dr. Michael Irving or Dr. Cheryl Irving in Toronto?
The name is familiar, but I don't, you know, the name's really familiar, but I don't know him personally.
I'll reach out to you after the show if that's okay with you. Dr. Michael Irving is a personal friend of mine, as is his wife. He created Canada's National Child Abuse Monument and has been attempting to get it placed for many years now.
Oh, right. Yes. Okay. That's
using
neat.
Art
okay.
therapy and thing, and a lot of what you were talking about was just, I've got to introduce the two of you. That's amazing.
Okay.
Tonight's about you and your
it.
Book and what you're doing. Oh, I just I'm excited to learn more.
Okay, good.
So you also indicate in your bio that I was reading that you have you're founding editor of an online magazine, The Trauma and Mental Health Report, with a visited by over 100,000 readers a year. Do you want to share a little bit about how that came to be and where it is today and how we can even get involved with that to support your work?
Yeah, for sure. So this is a terrific, it's number one, I just want to say this right off the bat, it's free. So if anybody is sort of thinking, oh gosh, this is a plug to, you know, it's actually free because in addition to being an author and a psychotherapist, a psychologist, I'm also a professor. And so part of my work as a professor is to disseminate knowledge to the general public about trauma. It's I think such an important thing. I think we as professors have done in general a terrible job at communicating to people in a way that is actually clear. Sometimes people use a lot of jargon in the writing. So what I've done is I've put together with my graduate students, doctoral students. So these are very bright young people who are very excited about helping and learning and bringing information about trauma to the community. So we write articles together. I mean, they do a lot of the legwork of writing. I do a lot of the editing and finishing touches on their articles. So you can see that their articles are written, that the articles are written by my students. And so what we do is we write articles about various issues in trauma and mental health in order to make the topic of trauma understandable and accessible to the general public. So one of our first articles that I love is called A Corporal Speaks, 10 Questions for a Canadian Who Served in Afghanistan. And it's an interview essentially with a Canadian soldier, so a serviceman, who was in Afghanistan and suffered from PTSD. But rather than going through all the different PTSD, this symptom and that symptom in a very academic way, it's a series of stories. And in this interview, this fellow talks about his personal story around trauma in Afghanistan. And it's a fascinating story. I mean, he served alongside American soldiers. He was guarding a facility, went on his scheduled break, an American soldier took over, and 2 minutes later, the American soldier was killed from some sort of gunfire. And this Canadian soldier realized, like, oh my God, you know, like, this person died, I didn't die, and he felt this horrible survivor guilt, you know, the sense of, like, because, you know, the Canadians and the Americans who served together, they were buddies. I mean, they got to know each other. They got to know each other's, you know, families, and, you know, they served alongside. And he said, you know, I remember in this interview, he just was devastated. It's like, you know, I he just felt like such a failure. I mean, but obviously he didn't do anything wrong. I mean, it was a scheduled break. He was supposed to, you know, leave his post, you know, at that time, and the other soldier was supposed to take over. So, you know, he didn't do anything wrong, but he just felt horrible, you know, basically, you know, just felt this terrible guilt. And so he suffered from PTSD because of that. And he talks about the story, and it's so interesting, you know, the experience. He was in Toronto celebrating, you know, our 4th of July is on July 1st. So, you know, Canada Day is July 1st. And so there are fireworks on the 1st of July all across Canada. He heard fireworks and he had some flashbacks, and he thought he was right back there in Afghanistan, and he was terrified and got really upset. And his girlfriend was like, what the hell is going on with you? So he suffered from PTSD for a few years. He went for therapy. It was hard at first, but it helped. You know, I mean, it took a couple of years. Not it didn't take forever, but it did take a couple of years. And he had a good therapist, and he found that it really helped. Then we had another interview with the soldier's sister, who talked about, it was a couple of weeks later. We posted this article. It was the experience of a. You know, the idea was, it was called The View From Here, the experience of having your loved ones in Afghanistan. So it was the experience of saying goodbye to people you love, seeing them go overseas to fight, and to not know if you're ever going to see them again. So there's a certain trauma that goes with that. And so she talked about that experience. It was just fascinating hearing these two, you know, the serviceman and his sister talk about their kind of parallel experiences, but from, you know, from across, you know, from different countries kind of thing. Those are just examples of some of our articles, but we try to engage in sort of teaching people about trauma through people's stories and through people's experiences and that sort of thing. So it's called the Trauma and Mental Health Report. And
I will tell you,
it's an online magazine.
Subscribe.
And sorry.
That's okay. No, please. It's your show. I just, while you were speaking about it, I went on my other computer and I subscribed to it. So I am now going to be getting your updates.
Okay, great. Yeah. So if you subscribe, if you Google the Trauma and Mental Health Report, you'll be able to go right to it and just subscribe, and you'll get once a week emails just saying there's a new article out. And again, it's free. So yeah.
Yep. And I subscribe, I encourage our listeners to subscribe as well. I was kind of looking it over real quick as you were describing, and it's definitely a useful resource. And I was identifying personally for a short period of time there with when you were talking about the military veteran and the loss of his comrade, you know, his brother, as we call ourselves in the military. I served 4 years, but I lost my own biological brother to murder when we were little kids, and I carried that mantle with me for many years. Like, I should have done something. I should have done more. I was the older brother. Mind you, I was 4 and he was 2. There wasn't much I could do. But it took me many years to understand that. So I immediately, when I heard what you were sharing, I immediately went over and I subscribed to it. I'm looking forward to the weekly updates. I want to get my co-host in here. She may have some things she may want to bring up. Carol, anything you want to talk about with Dr. Ruhmmiller as we go on?
Well, I've been listening, and, you know, quite frankly, trauma is trauma, you know. And I had friends that went to Vietnam, you know. And I always sit and watch the roll call, I think they called it, every night, because I was always so afraid that their names would show up as being dead,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very frightening thing to sit and watch and you know, you know, that war to me was a civil war. We didn't belong there, but that's another story. The point is our people were there. Yeah. And then also, too, I had friends that were in the front line. They were in the front line of action. And some came back with terrible mental disorders because of the trauma that they, you know, experienced over there. Another one came back. He was fine. He was a medic. And then he turned into a police officer. And then he became chief of police. But, you know, with the, you know, it's very sad what can happen, yes, from trauma.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're raising that. And I would like to say that, you know, across different kinds of wars and different kinds of military experiences, there are a lot of very, very consistent themes. One of the things that there was a book written a few years back by Daryl Paulson and Stanley Krippner. So these are military guys who, well, these were servicemen who I actually believe they were Marines who served in Vietnam and then became psychologists. And they talked about their experiences. And one of the fascinating things that they talk about, so I talk about this in my book, is the theme of betrayal. That many people, the ones who really suffered from PTSD, or you know, this is one theme. It's not the only theme, of course, but it's one important one, felt that they were betrayed by their country. And like the sense that you're betrayed is a theme that we see in trauma survivors, you know, people who were abused as kids, sexual abuse, they sort of feel betrayed by the adults in their lives. Sometimes when people have gone through abuse and then they report it, let's say to the non-offending caregiver, and if that non-offending caregiver blames the child, then they feel betrayed by that person. if people have been survivors of rape experience this idea, betrayal, when they have experienced rape and then they go to, the police. And if they feel, again, if they feel blamed, and I'm not saying that all police officers do this. I'm just saying that when that happens and they feel that the people who are supposed to be helpers, you know, whether it's nurses or police officers or psychologists, whatever they go to and they talk to, if they feel that they're being blamed for what happened, again, there's a sense of betrayal. And that's also true for soldiers who came back from Afghanistan, and so yeah, there's a sort of idea of betrayal by your country. That's a big theme, and mm-hmm. I think part of it is because, you know, we put so much trust. Again, it's that idea of trust that we're going back to that came up at the beginning of the show. You place trust in people in your life, and you have this illusion that we all walk around with, a kind of illusion that somehow we're okay, that people are going to be generally okay. You know, I'm going to leave my office tonight. I'm going to walk out on the street, and I'm not going to assume that I'm going to get killed, right? I walk with a certain kind of illusion in my mind that I'm going to be okay, that I'm going to make it home, that the world is generally pretty safe, you know. But that illusion gets shattered when you've been through trauma, and betrayal is an emotion that really shatters that illusion. It really makes you think, okay, even people close to me can harm me, and so therefore, can I trust anybody? And that's a tough thing to walk around with. It's one of the big pieces of post-traumatic stress disorder, I think.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I suffered too from PTSD. Today, I always tell Bill I'm 85 to 90% healed. You know,
mm-hmm.
Today,
okay.
I'm, you know, different today than I was, say, 10, 20 years ago, and certainly went through tremendous sexual abuse and physical and mental and emotional, whole nine yards. But,
it's so important that you're doing this work, Carol. I mean, I think it's such an important, both part of your healing and then healing others, you know,
mm-hmm.
kind of creating this dialogue. Gosh, I mean, it's just such an important thing.
Well, all the jobs
Absolutely.
I ever, you know, we go to, we're always social service. I worked in detention center. And of course, a lot of those kids there were abused. They came from abusive backgrounds. And I was part of the Rahway Lifers program, Scared Straight, and that was hoping that kids would do a turnaround and not become kids that ended up in detention center. I also worked at mental institutions, state mental institutions, as a technician, state certified though. So I understand what you're talking about with a lot of this, and trust is a big issue with trauma. People who have been traumatized, children. It's very hard even for adults. You go into your adulthood, and it's very hard to even trust people as an adult because somehow your mind always reflects back, you know, to the past. And this is something mm-hmm. I've learned to, you know, sort of like get a handle on, I'll use that phrase, you know, over the
mm-hmm.
years.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
A lot of what you're talking about has to do also with any kind of trauma, whether it be sexual abuse, whether it be related to war, whatever the trauma might be. And the PTSD is something that so often many of us, do develop. I had actually complex PTSD. And I had agoraphobia at one point. Terrible panic attacks, and I wrote a book too. So this is what we do. You brought up good things because you were saying before, earlier, how people, you know, express themselves, if you will. Maybe they'll write a book or some will write poetry. We have wonderful poets on NASCA. They do wonderful poetry.
Uh-huh.
There are people with artwork, you know, the art. There's people who do get involved with yoga, hypnotherapy, all different kinds,
yes.
EDM, you know, all those things that you've mentioned, you know. And certainly to find a good therapist, I have a gut feeling that you're a good therapist, is very, very hard. I think you are. But it's hard. It's not an easy task for a lot of people because they they have to be really trained about child abuse and trauma. And there are a lot of therapists out there that don't know. enough. Yeah.
And I Dr. Miller, I'd like to explore a little more about some suggestions for people who are struggling to open up, ideas on how they might be able to do that. Perhaps some of our listeners, both who are listening now and in the future, might be able to glean some ideas from you. Would you be able to share some of those concepts and ideas with us?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me say that, you know, it's an interesting segue. Let me say that some of the things that Carol mentioned are a nice segue here for this idea. Actually, artwork is really helpful for people who have had trauma and who have struggled regarding how to put it into words. If you're an individual who likes to draw or paint or do something like, you know, creative, it can be a very healing method to be able to express some difficult feelings. And I find that, this is true for people who, like I said, paint, draw. This is true also for people who are musical. Using an artistic form to express themselves is very, very helpful. Yoga is very helpful in trauma. I find that is, again, not everybody's cup of tea, but if it's something that is yours, there are therapists who are particularly trained in yoga for trauma survivors. And that's a very important thing because that also not only allows you to relax, but it also allows you something called emotional self-regulation. One of the things that's a difficult problem for trauma survivors is that they often feel like they get triggered by certain memories and they get triggered by certain events that happen in their lives, and then they feel like they're back there again. And so when you get triggered, it's such an automatic response that you can have difficulty, you know, being able to feel safe. And so relaxation strategies, art, these are all strategies that can help you feel a little bit more safe and is very helpful. These are what are called self-regulation strategies. And I also mentioned, self-defense martial arts. There was a period around 10 years ago when this was very popular for trauma survivors. I don't hear about it so much, and I don't understand why. I don't know what happened to this. It's every bit as useful today as it was 10 years ago. I mean, there were a lot of things written about it. Martial arts for trauma survivors, you know, women who have experienced rape or various other kinds of abuse, it creates a kind of control over your own body, a feeling of, I wouldn't say mastering your body, but a feeling that your body is, you know, that you have a say in what happens to your body if you engage in martial arts. And often when people have been through trauma, they feel that their body has betrayed them. They feel that they, you know, that their body isn't under their control in a sense, because they've actually had the control of their body taken away from them at times in their lives. So martial arts is a really wonderful technique for people being able to get that sense of control over your own body without having to engage in over-control or things like restricting eating or drinking or things like that. It's a wonderful strategy. And so I really highly recommend it. Karate, you know, you name it, Tai Chi, various kinds of martial arts are very, very helpful to be able to feel, also to feel like a little bit more like you have a sense of internal strength is the other piece that it allows. So those are some strategies that I would definitely say, if you're not involved in those and you have a trauma history, it's very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I can speak very, I can speak in support of the martial arts. 40-some years ago, martial arts helped me get through a lot of what was going on in my childhood. So you're right, you don't hear much about it anymore, and maybe perhaps it's something we need to bring back to the forefront, or at least bring people back aware of it. And many years of martial arts training taught me many things. And I remember my first 2 years in it, there was actually no physical combat training. It was mental training and how to use your mind to overpower your enemy before you used your body. So, yes, I was...
Yeah.
I'm a living testimony to what how martial arts can empower, and that's the word it did. That's what it did for me, and empowered me to take back control of that which was taken from me.
I
want to say about that. That's so true, Charlie. Because my husband was he didn't make black belt. He I don't know why he dropped out, except he had a lot of dents in his legs. He was a brown belt.
Okay.
Yeah. But he did teach me. He did teach me some of the things that he knew. And I always worked in high-risk jobs. And not that I ever wanted to use karate on anyone, but at least I knew I had that as a defense, all right, because I was so violated and so taken advantage of as a child in so many ways that if I could maybe use that as a form of defense. I keep using that word, defense, if I had to.
Mm-hmm.
And because we do feel so powerless, you know, as children. Mm-hmm. We are powerless.
Yeah.
We have no voice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have say over our body. So I think that martial arts is really a wonderful thing. And
it is, and to get with the right sensei and the entire thing.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. A good supportive dojo, not one that. Let me. There are a couple other points or topics that I think would be. How are we doing for time, by the way, Joe?
We've got about a half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'd like to. If you don't mind, bring up the topic of emotional abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I often get asked about this, and it's interesting because. We talk a lot about sexual abuse and physical abuse, and not to diminish how important those areas are. They're extremely important. But there were some really interesting studies done recently, and one study that came out of my graduate students here at York University, but other studies as well in Canada and in the U.S. as well, showing sort of looking at what were the consequences of different kinds of abuse and how much did they affect people in terms of symptoms and in terms of difficulties coping? And it turned out that emotional abuse or psychological abuse ended up predicting about as much symptom level, symptomatic difficulties about as much as sexual abuse and physical abuse. Now, I'm not trying to say, you know, any one person's abuse is more important or less important. All I'm trying to say is that as a group, we've really, in the field, really ignored the effects of emotional abuse. And this is a very important thing because this also connects to the idea of parenting. Kids who feel that they were, around emotional abuse, the idea of kids who feel that they were unwanted, kids who feel that they were not loved, so in situations where parents openly tell kids, "I wish you were never born," that kind of thing, growing up with that kind of idea, even if your parents never lifted a finger against you, has very profound consequences on children. And so we want to just think about this. Again, I'm not saying you need to coddle children and tell them that everything that they do is wonderful. All I'm saying is that in terms of if you want a child to grow up to be healthy and happy, children need to feel that they're wanted, that their parents actually, or their caregivers, or that the people in their lives actually think of them as being important. Not that they think that they're wonderful and that they do everything perfectly. All I'm saying is that they feel that they are important people and that they're loved. And that simple idea, that to know that you're loved or wanted, that your parents actually, or your caregivers actually, that you matter to them, that's really powerful. And we just don't want to forget about that. And when kids don't have that, they grew up with a sense of being emotionally like scarred. And that does have huge impact on their choices around relationships, on their sense of confidence and self-esteem, on their willingness to be assertive. All those things are strongly affected by emotional abuse. So I just wanted to bring that into the discussion because I think it's a very important issue.
And
I didn't know if you guys had some thoughts about that.
I am overjoyed that you brought that into discussion. Dr. Mueller, because it is, in my opinion, it's one of the most neglected, form of abuse, hardly spoken about, and not often enough people talked and discussed. So no, I welcome it. I'd love to spend the remainder of the show, if we can, on it, because it is a topic that isn't very well versed and brought out there. And as you were speaking, you talked about unwanted, and again, this is your show tonight about your book and what your admission is. But a week ago this evening, I was in a local pizza shop, and there on the wall is a poster that says unwanted. And I inquired about it, and it turns out a little boy from a 12-year-old boy who was 12 and a half when he wrote the book, about exactly what you were saying. He felt unwanted and unloved, and he went from the rejection of his parents, who both rejected him, the foster system who rejected him, and ultimately his paternal grandmother adopted him and now is raising him. And he said, you know, I thought it had to be my mom and dad that loved me and no one else could, because I felt unwanted until I realized that it didn't have to be them, that anybody could love me. And I just spent this past Sunday at this young man's first book signing, 13 years old, out here making amazing change. So
that's a really important point. So, Charlie, that's such an important point, that it doesn't actually, in a sense, I mean, parents obviously, you know, are going to be the individuals most in the best position to communicate this idea of their children being wanted. But it's very important to note that, you know, kids who are adopted into homes where they're wanted, they can turn out to be just as psychologically stable as a child who is the natural, you know, biological child of parents. I mean, the idea is it doesn't necessarily have to be the physical, biological parents. If somebody takes over caregiving for whatever reason, you know, sometimes in some families it's the grandparents who raise kids. Okay, if the child has at least one parent, or, you know, one parent figure, like a caregiver, an adult in their life who consistently is with them and is reliable and communicates that they love them, that is so important in terms of development. So yeah, it's interesting. So this was the grandmother that raised this boy?
The paternal grandmother, his father's mother, got him out of foster care. And got from bouncing from pillar to post, and so he wrote a book, and what he writes on the poster, I have it in front of me actually, because I'm now, and then tonight's about your book, your show. I just want to share this, because it was interesting when you brought up unwanted. Here we are again. This is a 12 and a half year old child wrote. His synopsis of his book was: a child growing up without his mother and father, not feeling wanted by anyone. I thought you had to be blood to love someone, but as I got older, I learned that anyone can love you. I mean, imagine from a 12 and a half year old child. That's amazing.
That's a nice summary of, there was a longitudinal study done by Emmy Werner on the island of Kauai, Hawaii, over the course of about 20, 30 years. I mean, she's tracked families over decades. And she found that families where kids had a sense of social support, particularly if they had one person who actually cared about them, even if they went through very, very difficult life events, those kids can turn out to be securely attached. So that is to say, if you had a caring aunt, a caring coach, a loving, one caring person. It could be an older sibling. If you had a caring individual who consistently was there and loved you, that can be enough to lead individuals, even who grew up in horrible circumstances, to feel what's called securely attached. To feel secure in their attachment. So this 12-year-old boy who wrote this book figured it out on his own, which is fabulous. You know, I love it when that happens. But it's also, by the way, corroborated by research, just, you know, FYI. So, interesting. Interestingly, in Emmy Werner's study, it also turns out that not only did kids who felt who were older siblings, who had support from older siblings, even people who provided support to others. So even if you feel loved by somebody, or if you give love to somebody, both of those experiences can be enough. You know, or either of those experiences can be enough to actually lead you to do much better symptomatically, even if you grew up in a terrible environment. So the idea is, you know, that interpersonal human connection is so critical for people. We are fundamental. Humans are just fundamentally social beings.
I couldn't agree more with that. One thing that we tell people at NASCA is if they're feeling very alone, and many people are alone, okay, and they turn to NASCA, you know, because they don't like that feeling of aloneness. Many times we tell them, if you go out and do volunteer work of some sort, it can actually help you, you know, it'll lift your spirits, and you'll be a person of worth, okay? So we feel so worthless so many times, you know, before we get on our healing journey and before we get to a certain point in our healing journey. Today I know I'm not worthless, but certainly years ago, and I'm Charlie, maybe he felt the same way, we all do, you know. We must be worthless people. Our parents didn't love us. They told me to run away all the time, and I did, and all this other stuff. Mm. So if people can learn, you know, to go out and go to a food shelter, go to a soup kitchen, whatever's available, or something through the church. A lot of times the church can tell you, you know, parents that need help or children that need help. If you offer your services, it can actually help you. You know, help you with your own self-esteem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
no,
what you just said is quite right. You know, 100%. I've seen it happen. Yeah.
100%.
Absolutely.
Can I bring another issue into the mix? If you don't mind, there's a topic that I
This is your show, Dr. Mueller. You can bring whatever you want into the mix.
Yeah.
So yes, absolutely.
No problem.
And we do have another member of our joins our panel. So at some point, I want to give our two panelists that we've had impatiently waiting up.
Nope.
Please bring another topic in. This is your show. We definitely want to expound on what
you're. I wanted to mention that one topic that's been more, I guess you could say, popular over the last few years is a topic that's very important in trauma therapy, and that's the issue of post-traumatic growth. And you know, sometimes. So the idea of post-traumatic growth, I want to bring it in there because it's sometimes seen as a little bit controversial, but I think also sometimes it's misunderstood. So post-traumatic growth is the idea that when people have been through trauma, they have to confront the elemental questions of life. They have to face questions like, you know, like the soldier did. Why not me? Like, you know, this American soldier was killed. Why wasn't I killed? You know, sometimes people have to face the question, why me? Why in a family where there were three or four children was I targeted by somebody to be abused and the rest of my siblings weren't, let's say. You name it. There are many questions. The shattered illusion idea. You know, here we are living in a world where we think we're safe, and then boom, we face the idea that no, actually, we're not nearly as safe as we think we are always. That kind of thing. So there are many fundamental questions about life in the world and our place in it that we have to face when we've been through trauma. And when people have been through trauma therapy, and I talk about this a lot in the book as well, when people have been through trauma therapy and it's in a trusting relationship and they go through the gradual process of building trust, they can then have the space psychologically to address these questions, these difficult personal questions about their life and the world. And what are they doing in this world that seems on the face of it so cold in a sense? So they have to face those questions, and they're tough questions. But if they've got a good therapist to help them work through it, they can experience growth in the process. So that's what's meant by post-traumatic growth. By facing some of these issues, they can actually grow from the process of wrestling with questions about themselves and their life in the world. And so then people grow from that experience, And so it can be very, very useful. One thing that I want to say is that sometimes people then misunderstand this and say, oh, well, the bright side of trauma is post-traumatic growth. Well, I would never, ever put it that way. It's not the bright side. There is no, in a sense, bright side. People who've been through trauma do not, you know, usually they wish, you know, honestly, they wish it didn't happen. I mean, if they had their way. But given that it happened, given that they've been through XYZ, it's helpful for people to then wrestle with some of these difficult emotional and personal questions. And that's where post-traumatic growth comes in. So, and that's why I talk about trauma and the struggle to open up from avoidance to recovery and growth. It's, you know, you want to help people recover. If you're a therapist, you want to help them recover from trauma, but not just recover. Recover is good. It's helpful. But if people can also, in a sense, be guided and helped to grow from the experience, to face some of these difficult issues, that can be very helpful to them. And so that's the other kind of piece I wanted to emphasize.
It most certainly can. And you've given our listeners and our panel here a wealth of information. I do want to thank Joe from Iowa, we opened up the show with him as a panelist. And we have a panelist join us a little later in the show. I'm going to bring up Seibel, I believe. I hope I'm not mispronouncing your name. Seibel from Florida, or Sybil from Florida. Are you with us? Hello? Maybe our guest from Florida isn't. We'll go
she
back
may
to
not.
Dr. Moeller.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Moeller, we have about 13, 14 minutes left. I want to take this to go wherever you feel you want it to go. I want to, again, this is your show. You've given us a wealth of information and knowledge. What do you feel? Is there anything else you want to touch on this evening with our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of issues. I mean, we've talked a little bit about the issue of. The process of therapy, the pacing of therapy. There's another important piece. This is maybe a little bit more relevant if you're a therapist, but if you're going through therapy as well, it also is relevant. And that is the idea that when you've been through trauma, it's very easy for people to get triggered. And this is true, Carol, you mentioned complex PTSD, complex trauma. Absolutely, mm-hmm. This is true in complex trauma, that it's very easy. And what I mean by triggered is relationships can trigger you. And so if you're, finding yourself, you know, reacting to something in a relationship, sometimes it's because aspect of what is going on in this relationship that is really a reminder of something else that happened earlier on in a previous relationship. So this can happen even in situations that seem on the face of it fairly innocuous. So it could happen, you know, sometimes with some of my clients, I'm just simply empathic with them about something. They talk about something and then the person gets kind of upset. And I don't exactly know why they're upset, but if you think about it, if you're empathic with somebody, you're creating a situation where you're joining with them. That can be very scary for a trauma survivor. If you feel that somebody understands you and joins with you and connects with you, that's risky because they could leave you and then where you're left, you know, you're left being very, very hurt, or they can manipulate you. You know, if somebody, you build trust with somebody, they can use that trust to manipulate you, or they can abandon you. You know, you build trust with someone, and the therapist says, I'm going to leave. You're taking a risk if you're a client and you're building this emotional relationship with a therapist. And when I say an emotional relationship, the reason I say emotional relationship is because therapy is an emotional relationship. You know, you're trusting a therapist with something very private, and that's a difficult thing to do. That's, you know, and then all of a sudden you find that your therapist matters to you and you care about them and you worry about them. And, you know, is my therapist going to be okay? You know, that sort of thing. So people, It's an actual relationship that you're building with the therapist. And obviously that's a huge responsibility for the therapist, and they need to observe good boundaries in the relationship so as to not take advantage of this in any way. But it is, it's called a therapy relationship. And so that very relationship can actually be triggering for some trauma survivors. And so the therapist who's aware of this uses that in a helpful way with the client. So they notice that something happened between me and the client. Let's say I was nice to the person and the person got upset with me, and then they start to talk about abandonment. And then I might wonder, what's going on here between us? Is something going on here? Did something I say upset you? And you kind of, if you're a good therapist, you use that moment that can be felt like a little bit of a conflict or a difficulty between the two of you to work through, hey, what's going on here? I noticed we were talking about this and you kind of got upset with me. Or the person maybe next week misses a session and or they come late and you sort of wonder about this because this isn't the person who normally comes late. And so, hey, is something going on here between us? And if you use kind of the two of you, the relationship that's going on between the therapist and the client productively, that can actually be a very helpful opportunity for trauma survivors, because they can start to learn that you can be, you know, you can feel upset with somebody and they're not necessarily going to yell at you or hurt you or take advantage of you or manipulate you or abandon you. They're going to, perhaps some people are going to actually care and listen and say, hey, you know, okay, I'm going to take your worries seriously. And you can work through that conflict. And if you do that well with somebody in therapy, that can be enormously healing. And that's also part of what my book is about, is how to, you know, really use the therapy relationship as an opportunity to see it like, in many ways, like another relation, like other relationships, and use it as an opportunity to heal. So that's another kind of thing that I wanted to bring into the mix here today.
Well, I think you did that quite well, actually. And it's true what you say, that years ago I went to therapists, and I did open up, and I was ready to open up, and I did grow fond of these people, and I was close with them, and they gave me a battery of tests, and they wanted me to be this, and one wanted me to be that, you know.
Oh, gosh, okay.
Yeah, and so, and it was all good, it was all good. But I think, like with traumatized people, especially people who suffer from complex post-traumatic stress disorder, I say suffered because I don't feel like I'm there anymore, thank God. But there's always going to be times when I can be triggered. Yeah, I can be triggered.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's something that that seems to follow us throughout our life because of the damage that was done when we were growing up, and because of the people in our lives who did, you know, more than just step on our toes. You know, they hurt us badly. Mm-hmm. And the trust issue is something maybe that I have to deal with for the rest of my life. And because that seems to be the way it is. You know, I get so close to a person and then I'm going to back off because that person might be a nut. That's the way I look at it.
Right,
You know,
I mean, yeah. Well, I know, you know, it's interesting, Carol, you raised the issue of being triggered, and, you know, because Charlie, you asked me earlier about some things that people who are listening can, you know, one thing that I think people can do also on their own, I mentioned a few things, but another thing that you can do really also on your own is start looking at your own triggers. That can be a really useful exercise. And one thing that I find that is helpful for people to do that is to do it in written form. And so, you know, where is a situation where you might be triggered? It's a situation where you find yourself feeling something. And I don't know what that something is because I don't know you, whoever the listener is, but you're feeling something and you're feeling it powerfully. And it kind of doesn't make sense to you. So you find, for example, you were at a whatever donut shop, and then something happened, and you got frustrated, and you were really mean to the server. And let's say this is not something that's typically you. You know, you don't go around being mean to servers in donut shops, but something happened there, and so you wonder, what the heck was going on for me? So if you sort of wonder to yourself, it's a situation where you were emotional or you shut down. You know, somebody said something private to you and you just had nothing to say, and you shut down in a way that's not characteristic for your typical way of being. Or you felt scared, or you felt, like I say, betrayed or abandoned, all of those feelings. It's really important to notice those moments, look at those situations, write them down. Who was around? What led up to that situation? And maybe wonder to yourself, why then? What was going on for me that I felt so that emotion, let's say, of rage, or that emotion of terror? Why then? What was going on for me? Now, you may not have the answer, but if you do this and start taking inventory of these things, you might find that there are patterns. You know, that there are various situations that really tend to make you very angry or make you feel very frightened or vulnerable. Maybe it's when people say very emotional things to you, or when people show you that they need you or they care about you, that you get scared and get emotional and pull away or whatnot. There are various patterns that you can start to notice. If you're motivated, of course, you can go into therapy and you can sort of address these with a therapist. But even on your own, noticing your triggers is a very useful exercise. And saying noticing a situation where you're feeling an uncharacteristic emotion very powerfully, and write it down. Ask yourself, who was around? What happened just before I felt that way? Why then? What was going on for me that I felt that way then? And again, you may not have the answer, but if you start to sort of take inventory of these things, if you start to sort of notice them and write them down, you might start to see patterns. And you can, you know, this is very useful when people start to notice patterns. Okay, this kind of situation really triggers me. And that's, again, something you might explore later in therapy if you're so inclined.
I think that's very good. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Charlie.
Like I said, I can identify, again, you're saying so many things I just so identify with. One of the things that took me the longest to understand, a trigger for me, is when someone laughs at me when I'm in the middle of something that I'm struggling with. Now, I realize laughter for some is just a venting. They're not actually laughing at me. They're laughing at the situation because that's how they deal with it. When for me it was like laughing at me reminded me of my mother when she would be beating me down and laughing hysterically as she was doing it. So when I hear laughter and I'm struggling with something, I for years would just draw right back and this anger would come up in me, and I had to learn how to deal with that. So, yeah, it's learning your triggers and then learning how to take mastery of them prior to them actually firing off. And before the trigger shoots its bullet out at you, being able to know when it's coming and be able to get your finger off of it before it goes off. So, yeah, just really great information.
Very good.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned, though, that situation reminds me a little bit of the idea of shame, that when people, we haven't talked about shame, was another important trauma theme, but yeah, when people are laughing at you or laughing and you're struggling, you can feel it as a shameful experience. And you know, in fact, sometimes they are trying to shame you. So it's not necessarily that you're just sort of imagining it. Sometimes they're actually trying to shame you. But then sometimes there are situations where, like you said, Charlie, that they're not intending to, you know, they don't mean anything by it necessarily in some situations, but it feels like it could be a huge trigger if you felt that shame in another situation in the past. It would be very powerful.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, Dr. Mueller, we are running down to the last 60 seconds, minute of our show. I didn't want to get away from us. I do would like you to give you the opportunity for some closing words and some, again, I encourage folks, please get onto his site, sign up for the Trauma and Mental Health Report. It is free. I did it when I subscribed. So the last minute's yours, Dr. Mueller. Run out what you need, whatever you feel you need to say as we close out this wonderful, awesome show.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess my a big and a very important point that I just want to make, and I said it right at the beginning, is for people to sort of be aware if they've been through trauma that they really are not alone. They may feel alone. They've been through something that often is kept as a secret, but there is actually help available. Good therapists there are some good therapists who deal with trauma, and so it can be a hugely growthful experience if you've been through trauma therapy with someone who's done this before and understands post-traumatic stress disorder. So I really encourage people, if you're feeling like you need help, to reach out and not to feel like you need to suffer alone. I do talk a little bit about this in my book, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up. So, hopefully you can find some of that in there as well.
Well, thank you, Dr. Muller. Thank you for an amazing, informative show. And we look forward to having you again as a guest.
Okay, no problem. My pleasure.
I'll know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. Blog Talk Radio.